All right. So this evening's talk is on change and karma. And so I am going to talk about karma, but I am not going to talk about reincarnation. That's going to be the next talk I give, what reincarnation means from a Buddhist perspective. So, but to understand the thing that I like about this topic is that it is really illustrative of the fact that all of the teachings interlink, so that both the to understand karma, you have to understand the Buddhist concept of change, which is a unique concept, and to understand the Buddhist idea of reincarnation, which is difficult to understand. You have to understand change and karma. And so it's not as if you just find a great book and read the chapter on karma and you're going to understand reincarnation, or you're going to understand change. You know, they're completely interrelated. So with that, the several weeks ago I gave a talk on change, and you know, the Buddhist idea is that there's nothing that's permanent, right? But at least for our lifetime, there is one constant, and the constant is that everything's changing. You know, that there is this stream of experience. If you just think of today, of the mood that you were in when you woke up, and then how you were feeling during the afternoon, and what happened when you walked in this building. You know, it's just this river. It's much bigger than a stream. It's just this river of constantly changing thoughts, emotions, sensations, experiences. And I've always been struck by the fact of the Buddha commenting on this in his dying words. Does anybody remember what the very last thing the Buddha said?
Strive on diligently.
Well, just immediately before that. But that's right. Yeah, I mean, strive on diligently, or strive on.
Be a lamp to yourself.
Nope.
Everything changes.
It was close to the end.
Nope. That was. So I'm talking about he's on his deathbed. And he says something on his deathbed, not a discourse he gave. Okay. So anybody have a guess? Okay. So he said these two things that are linked together. Renee was right. You know, that he said strive on diligently. You know, but before that, right immediately before that, he said all conditioned things are subject to decay. Strive on diligently. And the Buddhist notion of change is linked to the idea of conditionality. It's not just that things are changing. It's that they are changing in a particular way, that they are being conditioned as part of the change. So that the moment before this moment, something was happening in our mind and our body, a thought, an emotion, a sensation, and in some way that conditions this moment now. And so if you think of any idea, any principle that you were unaware of in Buddhist practice, and then you became aware of it. Well, the moment before and the moment after are different. You know, that moment of awakening to some principle that could apply to your life, or that you're in meditation and you have a deep insight about yourself. That insight arises because of what you were doing before that. It doesn't arise on its own. So change is constant. The change is conditioned by what precedes it. And so all Buddhist thought, all Buddhist practice is based on cause and effect. But what I do now has an impact on what happens in the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment. Okay? It's a starting place. And another way that you can think of this is we know that the core problem from a Buddhist perspective is suffering. And we can actually feel that in our body. You know, not to do too much with this, but on election night, I want to make this for real, okay? All of us had some idea of what was probably going to happen. And then depending on, you know, if you were glued to the TV, which would be suffering, or you were periodically checking in, you know, to find out what was happening. Just think of that evening, whoever was your guy or gal, okay? Just think of that evening, how you felt that afternoon, and then what started happening during the evening, and then there's a result, and what happened with that result. It's perfect illustration of causation being conditional. You know, every moment. I mean, my experience was, you know, I'm watching this, and at first, like, I was really confused because I had done what apparently all the pollsters and everyone had done, and was doing exactly what the Buddha warned us not to do, mm-hmm. about making assumptions, mm-hmm. right? So I had a bunch of assumptions in my mind, and I'm watching, you know, I'm watching this map and the color changing. And initially, it's like I was kind of disoriented and confused. Like, I wonder what's going on. And so then I started telling myself, "Oh, I know what it is. I know what it is. You know, I don't understand how the vote's coming in these individual states. So, you know, what's going to happen is that, like, in X state, in, you know, the last 2 hours is going to be 70% of the vote is going to come in, right? And, like, all the pollsters and everybody know this because, you know, I mean, they have this supposedly down to a gnat's hair. And so that's the explanation for what appears to me to be so confusing, right? So then, of course, it started becoming clear to me that wasn't the case, and it wasn't that I was confused, that something was actually happening. But, you know, in each one of those moments, if you could take a snapshot of your state of mind and your state of emotion and think of it that way, you can just see how the moment before is conditioning it, right? And then just keeps conditioning it. So it's moment by moment, and it's cumulative. Right. By the end of the night, before it was clear what was happening, I was so anxious I couldn't believe it. And it wasn't anxious just because the moment before something had happened. It was because there were a whole series of moments that were cumulative that were coloring my mind and what have you. Okay. So, of course, the trick is, and this is one of the core ideas about karma, is that we have this stream of mind states and emotions, experiences, events coming into our life, and in each moment we have a choice of what to do with it. So when we talk about continuity of awareness, and the Buddha says things like, you know, one moment of mindfulness is the equivalent of an entire lifetime without mindfulness. Well, you hear that and it's like, what does that mean? You know, that rationally, you know, it's like, that doesn't even make any sense, right? And the reason it does make sense is that this moment conditions the next, and if I could actually wake up to that in this moment, it changes my conduct in the next moment, and in the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment. So the most difficult part of practice is actually accepting the truth that in every moment there is a choice. And just think about your day. How many times during the day did you have a mind state present that you would prefer not to have, or something was happening and the idea did not come into your mind, I have a choice about this? Right? So, I mean, this is the key to it. It's like actually waking up. First of all, there's this stream of things coming through our minds, affecting our minds and our body, and we actually have a choice about every moment. That in any given moment, if we can wake up, we have an opportunity to do something with that. We have an opportunity to practice, to point our mind in a particular direction. And with respect to karma, you know, we talk about, well, you're making karma, you're making good karma, you're making bad karma, which we'll get to in a second. But not making a choice, by not being awake to the fact that you do have a choice, is creating karma. It's creating a momentum in the wrong direction, because you're just unconscious and on automatic pilot. So I always find that kind of a scary thought, you know, because I've been practicing for a long time. You know, I perceive myself as a pretty good practitioner. I say to myself that I'm trying to practice hard, you know, that I have an intention to wake up. And then I look at my daily life and I realize that most of the day I'm not fully aware of what I just said. I understand it completely intellectually, but actually still bringing it home, you know, more and more and more and more in my life, I can really see that what a challenge it is. So this is, you can see how these things link together, right? Okay, we've got change that's conditional. It's the stream of activities. We choice, and those choices point our minds in a certain direction. And you know, it's kind of like, you could either use two different analogies. One analogy is, you know, the water that's dripping on a rock, or a wave that's hitting on a shoreline. Okay, well, at the moment, it doesn't seem like a very big deal, right? Just look at it, and just a little drop of water, you know, it's probably going to stop dripping, and then it keeps dripping for 20 years. And, you know, there's a big hole in the ground. Or the coastline, you know, is slowly receding and houses are starting to fall in the water. So these things that we are not awake to, but are happening all the time, are reinforcing our mind being pointed in a habitual or automatic way. And so if we are not awake and not making choices, from a Buddhist perspective, and the thing, well, we're creating karma, well, we're That just means we're reinforcing these habits that keep us in suffering. And then the reverse. You know, if we start to wake up and we start to cultivate healthy habits, and particularly if we start exercising restraint, then we start to point our mind in a different direction. Okay. So one way to think with this line of thinking, one way to think of karma, it's not the best way to think about it, but it's the way we think about it a lot, is to think about karma as a result. Okay, that based on your choices, that something happens. You know, that we become a certain kind of person, or we don't become a certain kind of person. So I just made a short list here of, well, what kind of choices are we potentially talking about? Okay, you know, just on a daily basis. So it would be choosing anger over kindness. You know, something comes up and the automatic response I have is to start to get pissed off, and I just go with that, you know, rather than pausing and seeing it clearly, making a choice about it and trying to bring kindness to it, you know. So in that moment, we're pointing our mind in a particular direction, you know. If we have a problem with anger, if we have a problem with anxiety, if we have a problem with depression, you know, just, you know, pick your favorite one. Those are all choices. You know, like, am I going to do something about this in this moment? You know, but I have to be awake enough to see it. I mean, this is the whole key about practice, right? Is that it's if we could see it afterwards and then learn from it, that's fantastic. But what we're trying to get to is in the moment, as it's unfolding, to be awake to that moment. And this is the reason that our meditation practice is so important. I mean, why is it in our meditation practice? You know, we just had a little 45-minute intro thing. Why is it that we want to see that a thought enters our mind, it's a particular kind of thought, it has a reaction on our body? Because of this? Because then we can wake up to it. We can see it. So, you know, it's nice to have kind of a sleepy, dreamy, comfortable sitting, to have a nice meditation nap. But it doesn't get you to this. It's not going to point your mind towards freedom, right? And so it's in meditation, in this intense, more intense environment where we're watching sensations in our body, that we start to see things, and we start to see how they feel, so we don't have to intellectually be watching for them. It starts to become intuitive and spontaneous because we feel it in our body and we feel it in our mind and wake up. That's the mechanism, okay? So one in daily life would be choosing anger over kindness. Another would be choosing avoidance or denial over actually engaging and working with issues, which my guess is that that's this last week. Seriously, this is what a lot of people, I think, have been doing, you know, choosing avoidance or denial over actually engaging and working with whatever the issue is. Well, you know, you're either reinforcing a negative pattern and habit in mind, or you're cultivating a positive one. It's always the choice. Okay. We choose distancing ourselves from an experience rather than actually opening to it. You know, this Buddha here, opening to it, bringing it in, and working with the energy of it. Choosing raw desire or aversion over restraint and ethical conduct. So that could be speech, it could be behavior. I kind of like that. Raw desire or aversion. choosing control and certainty over openness, discovery, and spontaneity. I'm like, I got to have everything the right way or I can't feel safe. I got to lock everything down, you know, or I can't do it. I got to know what's going to happen or I don't want to be involved in it. Okay. And, the other principle of a Nietzsche change and impermanence is like in every moment there is this new possibility if we could actually be awake to it. Failing to act when action is called for. Acting when inaction is called for. You know, basically, restraint and cultivation worded a different way. So from a Buddhist perspective, what karma is about and what change is about transformation. So if we're awake to the fact that we have a choice and we have practice tools and we bring things in and work with them, we start to transform how we handle them. And in doing that, our approaches to dealing with issues, aversive states of mind, challenges start to change. They start to become more spacious. Our ability to deal with things becomes more powerful. So change in our attitude, states of mind, emotional responses, reactivity, all begins to change. Starts to transform. If we're not doing that, they don't transform. They don't change. What they do is they solidify, they reify. So if I keep reinforcing the way an anxious way or a depressed way of dealing with challenge and change, my ability to deal with change starts to diminish. And I become more anxious and more challenged because what I'm doing is just solidifying a limited way of responding to change. So I actually end up, I mean, why is it that for many people, if not most people, as they grow older, they become more set in their ways. Mm-hmm. They complain more and they become more reactive. Well, it's kind of like reverse transformation. It's like rather than with this practice, we become bigger, we become more open, we become less judgmental, we become kinder. It just keeps getting bigger. You know, the circle of compassion and just keeps, you know, what Einstein was saying, you know, the family keeps getting bigger. You know, we start actually seeing that while we all actually look different, that if you look really closely, you know, like actually look in somebody's eyes, that there's somebody back there that isn't their appearance. And it's the same, whatever it is, it's the same thing when that person looks in your eye that they're seeing. And, you know, we start to actually begin to feel that, you know, and to embrace that. But if we're not awake and we're not making choices and we're, then everything starts to become smaller, becomes more solid, okay? It becomes the basis for not just fear, but stronger fear. And being afraid of change, which, frankly, I think this is a description of this last election. You know, these Dharma principles apply across the board to everything. If you just want to look and see, you know, they're there. So over on the far wall, on the right-hand tanka, is the Wheel of Life, right? And it goes through these stages, and it explains how we personalize events and suffer. Okay. And so the objective is we're trying to get outside of, we're not trying to get out of the box, we're trying to get out of the circle. We're trying to get off the wheel of suffering. And I've always liked that because the first time I saw it, I thought of my father. And I think you've heard this story before, but I think it's probably a long time since I told it. But my father was a business executive, and he had this little postcard up on his dresser. And I didn't get it for the longest time. And I always wondered, like, why has he got that up there? Okay. So it's a little postcard, and, you know, this is like when I first saw it. This is back in the 50s, you know, like when most men wore hats, you know, and my dad was kind of a dapper guy, and he really dressed smartly, and he always wore a hat, you know. Like when he was casual, he had, like, the French
berets.
He had a whole collection of berets. He just loved berets. So this picture shows a businessman with a suit and a hat on and a briefcase, and he's inside one of the exercise wheels, like for a rat or a gerbil. Okay? You know, he's like this. And underneath it says, if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. So it took a while before I got why he had that up there. And he would always tell me this story. He had this secretary who I eventually, the business he was in, he was the vice president of a potato chip company. So he'd take me down to the plant on the weekends, you know, and he'd work, and I'd fool around, and then he'd let me go in the back where the potato chips were coming down, you know. And it's just incredible, you know, being in a potato chip factory with these fresh potato chips coming down. You know, you'd have to just drag me out of there. But he had the secretary, and they'd been together for a long time, and he said, you know, after they had gotten to be friends, he noticed that she would always spend some time during the lunch hour. She'd close her door and, you know, be quiet. And he was a very high energy guy, so he did a lot of physical things, and his meditation was judo. And he was the first Caucasian that was admitted into a Japanese judo club in California. There was a color line. And I've got a picture of him here at a tournament, and they're all lined up in front of the state capitol. And there's 227 of them, and there's one Caucasian, all the rest are Japanese, you know, a little white face in there. So he asked her, you know, well, what did she do, you know, during lunch to kind of help her be balanced? And he'd always talk about, like, just how calm she was, you know, like she'd never get ruffled. So she said to him, well, do you want me to show you what I do? And he said, well, okay. So he said, okay, she said, well, just be quiet and watch this right here on my forehead, okay? So she closes her eyes, and I don't know if it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you know, but this area starts to get red. And then it gets really, really red, and she still has her eyes closed and says to him, go ahead and touch it. And my father said he touched that, and it was like, almost, you know, almost felt like it was burning. And so she had this unbelievable concentration practice. And that's what she would do during the lunch hour, you know. So so there's all these kind of linkages between my father's experience and exploration of things and then later in my life. But, you know, that's an illustration of a choice, right? She was in a very, very stressful job. She had an enormous amount of responsibility, and she took care of herself. And she took care of herself with the kind of tools that we have, you know, and she knew that taking care of yourself from this perspective, although I think she was a Hindu practitioner, had to do with developing skills that have to do with self-awareness and your ability to see and work with your own mind states. So every day she was rather than, you know, the drop of water dissipating something, taking it apart, she was slowly, cumulatively cultivating, building something, right? So this is a practice about, on the one hand, building, and on the other hand, using restraint to begin to diminish the strength of and eventually eliminate the tendencies of mind we have that hurt us, that point us into suffering. Okay, so let's talk about karma as what it really is. And what it really is it's a process. And it's a process that relates to change and choice. So most of the time you hear people talk about karma as having to do with action. You know, like, I did something that was not helpful, was not good, I harmed someone, and there's going to be a karmic result of that. And that's true. But that's really, when it's worded that way, that's really a misstatement and a misunderstanding of what karma means from a Buddhist perspective. And this is really fascinating for me because there is a sutta where the Buddha is, like the talks that he gave, the discourses, the suttas, many of them are set up in a way where he is either talking with or kind of debating with someone who is taking a position which is not the position of his teachings, or is the teaching of another major school at the time that he did not agree with. So, like, if you go through all of the suttas, there are references, explicit references, to 64 different systems of thought or schools that he disagreed with. And so many of the suttas are taking apart what are some of the predominant and powerful thinking and teachings of the day by other schools. And the Buddha and the Jains were two of the biggest schools that came out of this non-organized, non-religious groups of people who all started with aesthetic practices. They were not part of any recognized religious organization or system. And so just about at the same time, the leader of what became the Jains, which still exists today, and what became Buddhism, those two men were about the same age and began teaching at the same time and began having followers. And so there's this one sutta where the Buddha is talking with a follower of the Jains, and it's about, well, what is the effect of, what is it that determines the impact or the effect of what we do? You know, what is karma? And the Jain practitioner puts out what the Jane theory was, and continues to be the Jane theory. And the Jane theory is, it's what you do. So what I do externally is what determines the karmic effect of that. Okay. And the Buddha's position was, it's not what you do out there, it's what you do in here. You know, everything with Buddhism starts internally. The thought is what I do externally is merely an expression of what's happening inside. So the Buddha's position is that my intention is the single most important thing. Because if I am actually in touch with, I first of all have to be clear about my intention. Okay. And then secondly, I have to be in touch with it. I have to be connected to it. And if I do, when the moment of choice comes up, what's going to govern what I do is my deepest intention and the fact that I'm actually connected to it. And then that's going to result in action. So that's going to result in my saying something, in my doing something. Okay. Does that work? So historically, this is a huge thing. You know, I find it fascinating that historically the Jains basically said, well, you know, I could have a bad intention, and as long as the action turns out to be okay, it doesn't matter. Okay. And of course, you know, our practice is just the reverse, right? Like, if my intention is wrong, even if I do something that's good in the outer world, that may have a good effect, but the fact that I had an intention that was not a healthy intention pointed my mind to reinforcing an unhealthy intention. So even though there's a good result out there karmically for me, the most important part is that my intention was wrong. Okay? So I'm always fascinated with this situation, and you may have had this experience as well. You have an idea of who you are. You know, you have kind of. Well, I'll just talk about myself. You know, I have this idea about myself that like I'm basically a good person. You know, and that basically I'm a kind person, and I'm a compassionate person. Okay. And that I've been working on myself for a long time. And then I see myself do things that are completely inconsistent with that. You know, I do something, and afterwards it's just like, I mean, how could I do that? You know? So does anybody have any... I hope I'm not the only one having this experience.
No, you're not.
So does anybody have an idea of why that happens?
Is it ingrained or something?
Our condition.
Yeah, there's actually two answers to it, okay? The first one is... we have mental form, you know, in Buddhism they're called mental formations. They're these deep, deep habits of mind. So it may be true that your intention is to act in a certain way, but placed in the right circumstance, you just go on automatic pilot and you're reinforcing this negative habit. Okay, so taking it back to the start of the talk, the mental formation comes up and is more powerful than the intention. So you can't see that you have a choice. You don't see that you have a choice. You just act, and then you're confused afterwards. How could I do that? Well, actually, it's pretty simple, you know. And every time you do it, you're karmically reinforcing this habit of mind that is unhealthy and causes you to suffer. You know, afterwards going, how could I do that? It is a form of suffering, right? It's a painful form of suffering. The other thing, and this is more subtle, and this is the thing that is, from my perspective, really important to understand about Buddhist thought and practice, is that it is deeply layered in terms of understanding what it means. And there's levels of subtlety. So as your mind begins to become more and more quiet, not silent, but quiet. Quiet meaning that it's not agitated. Okay? So you can have all kinds of thoughts and things going on in your mind. It's not silent, but it is quiet. The mind itself is quiet because all this reactivity and judgment isn't going on. You know, it's a stream of things flowing by. The mind isn't grabbing onto them. It just remains settled and quiet. And so the other thing is that we are not fully connected to our intention. We are not strongly connected to the intention, so that the mental formation, it's not much of a fight, you know. So if you think of, like, you know, a tree and a taproot, it's like, well, gee, you know, I have an intention to be a compassionate person, but that taproot doesn't go down very far, you know. So it's like over in Campus Commons, a lot of these trees, you get a lot of rain, it gets soaked, the wind comes, it just falls over. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the idea of, you know, how can I become more directly connected with my intention? How can I develop my intention? Becomes, if you understand this principle that I've laid out, and, you know, we're calling it karma, we can put any name, we could call it mayonnaise. You know, mayonnaise has, like, a really big impact on our lives. You know, and it's just basically, choice has consequence. We have to wake up to the fact that we have a choice and then work with the tools that we have. So, I know you've heard this story, but in this context, I want to repeat it because I think it's so important. On our pilgrimage, the last pilgrimage in India, we had this bus driver whose name was Sean. And just a really cool guy. I got an email from him yesterday. Okay, again. And he always, as a sign of respect, he calls me Daddy. You know, it's a younger man, older man thing in India. So he said, Daddy, how are you? You know. And his English was pretty good, but not great. And I speak no Hindi at all. But we really got along, and we had like this whole sign language thing that we had kind of figured out to do about things. And so I'll just make this story really short. He had this object hanging from the rearview mirror, and the bus we had was one of these panoramic fronts, you know, so it was really big. So he had this thing, you know, and it's always doing this. So, I don't know, maybe three quarters of the way through the pilgrimage, he and I, it kind of became a habit that everybody would get off the bus and I would stick around, and he and I would just kind of talk. And so I said to him, well, you know, what is this that you have hanging? And it looks like a human being that's flying like this, and then he has two things in the hands. And he says, well, it's Hanuman. And I said, okay, well, I thought it was Hanuman. And Hanuman is, you know, it's an embodiment. It's half monkey, half man. And depending on the story that's involved, he's the embodiment of service. So Ram Dass Foundation is called the Hanuman Foundation, you know, service. So we started talking about that. So then I said to him, I said, well, why do you have that hanging in the window? And it was the only time in the whole trip that he kind of looked at me like, gee, that's a stupid question. You know, and so he kind of gave me this funny look, and then he said, I have Hanuman there to protect me, so I can protect you. You know, so, and this guy was a gorgeous bus driver. I never thought of someone being a complete artist by driving a bus. And he would take us into places where you drive in and you go, I can't believe that he's going to try to go through that space. And he, I mean, that bus was an extension of his body. It was unbelievable. I mean, it was like this on both sides, you know, and he would, incredible, you know. So this idea, for me, this goes to being connected with your intention, you know. This guy was a deeply spiritual person. And he was completely connected, had connected his job and his spirituality. There was no separation. They were completely linked. And he had Hanuman there as the reminder, you know, that he protects me so I can protect you. And, you know, that has become an inspiration for me. You know, ever since I had that discussion with him, that's what I'm looking for. It's like a straight line between these teachings and my life and my spirituality and my conduct. You know, he protects me so I can protect you. Unbelievable. I mean, what an unbelievably straight line between his spirituality and his life and his conduct, you know. So if we're serious about the choices we make actually have consequences, and they have cumulative consequences, then really spending some time reflecting on, well, what is our true intention? And how do we manifest that intention? You know, I mean, it's one thing to say, gee, you know, I want to be a good meditator, or I want to be, you know, a good person in the sense of Buddhist ethics, or, you know, I'd like to get as awakened as I can this time around. It's easy to say that. And, you know, you can do a number of things, and it's easy to even be telling yourself that you are doing it. But if you really sit down and say, you know, like, this is serious stuff. Like, the choices I make have, like, really serious consequences. Then the way you look at everything looks totally different. You know, it's like, well, maybe what I'm doing is I have a hobby. And maybe what I want is something more than a hobby. I mean, maybe I actually want to change some of these deep habits of mind that I have. Maybe I want to do that for myself, and I want to do it for my spouse and my children and my grandchildren and the people that I'm with in my spiritual community, you know. So it really takes us to the question of, do we really want to get free of suffering? I mean, do we really want that? And, you know, we say, well, the root of all problems are either desire or aversion. But there is healthy desire. There's aspiration. And so this notion of, well, do I really want to get free, is a profound question. And it creates the direct line to daily life. Because if we want to get free, we wake up to choice. And every moment a choice, and in every choice a consequence. So, both in terms of our practice, this is my closing, both in terms of my practice and the aftermath of the election, you know, I've been thinking about Mahatma Gandhi, and he said that the future depends on what we do now. Not on today, what we do now. And that's what karma's about. You know, it's like, you know, the old thing about, well, when is now? Okay, well, okay, it's now. Okay, it's now. It's now. You know, it just, it keeps being now, you know. And so in every moment of choice and in every choice of consequence, and then that spans an entire lifetime. And it influences everyone around us. You know, I think a lot. This little child, this little grandson that's come into my life, has been a real jump starter for me in terms of my spiritual practice. You know, because I'll catch myself doing things in front of him, and they're not particularly bad things, but. I know that I may be planting a seed in his mind. And it's really fascinating. He's developed this little habit where if I get upset about something, you know, he'll do something and, you know, I catch myself getting upset about it. And he can see, now he can see, before he couldn't, but now he can see that I'm catching myself. Okay? And he knows that it's not good, that it's a toxic thing. At some level, he understands that. And the way he's responding to this at the moment, because what I was doing was, you know, like I'd get upset and I'd say something. Okay, so well, now I get upset and I'm restraining myself, but he can still see the reaction. Okay. And before, I would say something and then catch myself. And then I would try to rebalance the situation, you know, and say something good to him and hug him and kiss him and what have you. So now when he sees I'm restraining myself, he'll say, that's really funny, right? That's, you know, it's like he knows that that whatever that is hot stuff. We don't want to go there. You know, he knows that. Mm-hmm. And so he spontaneously, it's amazing, you know, it's like, okay, let's lighten the situation up. You know, because he saw that before that's what I would do, right? Yeah. So this is his little way of trying to do that. You know, like, okay, you and I are okay, right, Poppy? You know, it's basically that's what he's saying, you know. So, so there it is, you know, like he's seeing that restraint on my part, and it feels like that's good for him. You know, he's seeing that the dynamic and then trying to deal with it. So, but yeah, the future depends on what we do now. So, okay, so we've got a few minutes. For if you have questions or comments before we take off.
What choices do you think you had as you were listening to those election results in each moment?
Well, the first one was I said to myself, I wonder if I have any safety razors in the bathroom. So that was one. Another one was, I wonder how much Grey Goose vodka I have in the kitchen. These were the ones that weren't so healthy. Okay, but in all seriousness, I could see that I had an experience with 9/11 that it profoundly affected me. And from a dharmic perspective, it really affected me in many ways, but I made a real mistake because I was kind of glued to the TV for 2 or 3 days, and every story would show one of those towers coming down again. And I realized that at the end of those couple of days, it's the same thing, you know, it's like, we have a negative idea in our mind and we just keep repeating it to ourselves and just begin. Well, by the end of those 3 days, I was just completely traumatized. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it was, in large part because I just kept going back and seeing these images and reinforcing them. So that night when I saw this starting to go down, you know, I said to myself, yeah, I've got to be really careful because I think I know where this is going, and I know it's going to be very emotional for me, and it's going to, you know, the model basically is, and I think we can all relate to this, you know, here I am, you know, I'm okay, you know, I'm really interested, I'm curious. Something starts to happen, and then that starts to trigger a mental formation, like, oh my God, you know, like what's coming, which starts to trigger an anxiety response. Mm-hmm. And then that starts to trigger this kind of downward spiral in addition to the anxiety, you know, almost starting to start depression. And then the next step is that if you don't do something about it, your mind's going to start ruminating on it, papancha, and it's going to start to escalate in power, and then it's going to start to turn into catastrophizing and panic and all mm-hmm. kinds of things, right? I mean, we. So I really see that about myself from 9/11, and I was looking at this thing, and I said, man, I got to be careful with this. I mean, tonight, for me personally, much less the country, but for me personally, this is a dangerous night for me. And I have to be careful what I do. So after 9/11, I call it an information diet. It's basically, you know, the choices are restraint or cultivation, right? And so I said, I'm not going to sit here and just stay here and watch this unfold. I'm not going to do it because I know it's going to take me down. So what I'm going to do is once an hour, I'm going to go back and I'm going to look at these two different shows and see what they have to say, you know, two different perspectives. And so that's what I did. And then by doing that, you know, I had a sense of relief. And, you know, I went and did other things that were comforting or soothing for me in between. And part of that was sitting, you know, because I could already see, you know, like just when I got it where it was going, you know, or I thought I knew where it was going before anybody started saying that's where it's going, I could just feel this enormous sense of this flush of anxiety as well. You know, I better sit, right? And try to balance that out, just exactly what I was saying, you know, bring it in, okay, open up to it, let it go, just settle, keep, you know, the whole idea is of mindfulness is having the mind in balance so we can see clearly and respond to things. So that's what I did, and then late in the evening when everybody knew what was happening, and then, you know, they're kind of doing these postmortems. At that point, I felt strong enough because of the way I had handled the evening that I was really curious. I wanted to hear what people who are supposedly experts had to say of why everybody had it so wrong, you know. And so it became like a real point of curiosity for me. And then that allowed me the next morning, rather than just to be like completely traumatized and just wanting to stay in bed or stay in the bathtub, to actually reflect on this thing. And I said to myself, then what I did is back to the Black Buddha. I said, I cannot, for my own health, I cannot not engage this. Because if what I do is try to escape this, it's going to set a frame in my mind that is going to be really hard to get rid of because you know what's coming. So what I did was I went, and some of you got an email on this, I went and to Mr. Trump's webpage, and I looked at his 100-day plan, which from, you know, from where I'm coming from as a person and as a Buddhist, it is a little horrific. And what was fascinating is I read that thing and I went through it very slowly, and I had a great sense of relief. And the reason I had a great sense of relief is that the fear and the anxiety was not generalized. It wasn't amorphous, like, oh my God, you know, this terrible thing's going to happen. It's like, well, there it is. That's where I get to start. That's what I have to work with, you know. And the sooner that I start reflecting on this and thinking about it, the better I'm going to be, rather than like every time I turn on the news and hear that somebody's talking about one of those planks, you know, it's like another assault on me. You know, it's like, no, I know, I've heard that. I know that's coming, okay? So then I can be curious about it. And I can decide, should I act? Should I not act? Should I reflect? You know, a lot of this is just having a calm mind or getting into a place of balance and just listening really, really, really deeply about what should I do or not do. You know, I don't feel compelled to run out and do anything right now. That's not my role. My role is to take this practice and to be as awake as I can internally, my internal events and external events, and then just keep asking, you know, what should I do? What is the skillful thing for this particular human being with everything I've got in my life and everything? What should I do or not do, you know? So it's kind of a long answer, but I think this idea of protecting ourselves when we need to protect ourselves is very important, you know, and nourishing ourselves when we're facing challenge and we're under stress, and with this we're under some big time stress, you know. So whatever it is that nourishes you to do more of that, bring more of that into your life, because that's one of the ways that we're going to be able to maintain some level of balance and a sense of healthy continuity in our life.
So. A question about you when you talked about thought, intention, and then action. Like, I've heard in the past, like, I'm not responsible for my first thought, but I'm responsible for my first action. So the thought, say you have thought A and thought B. Thought A is negative, thought B is positive. So you react to thought B and your intention is positive. Then will those intentions eventually change your mind state?
Okay. Does everybody think they heard that? Okay, well, it's basically about thought, okay?
Yeah.
And we did a little beginning meditation class, and one of the things I said was that the issue is not that you have a reaction. And we all have reactions, right? If something happens and I have a thought, I have an emotion, that's not the problem, because we're not going to eliminate all of those. Somehow instantaneously, over a period of time, those are going to diminish. So that's not the issue. So like you're saying, the first thought, I'm just going to really put this out here, okay? Let's say the first thought is the voice of some voice in your past, and it's a racist thought, okay? That's not the problem. The problem is what you do with it. Because it's already happened, right? So now there's the moment of choice, okay? So then, you know, I decide what to do with it, right?
Okay.
Yeah, so that is the moment.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. The first one is, you know, the habituated stuff that's stuck mm-hmm. in us speaking, mm-hmm. okay? The second one is whether we're going to create new good karma or bad karma, okay? And this is, and then here and I'm just going to say this and then we're going to close, it's time. Here's one of the difficult realities of everything I said tonight. Okay. And what it is that every unresolved thing that we have in our life that we know is like hot material, and it's still there, and we've been avoiding it, and we haven't dealt with it. All of that stuff has, in this context, a really negative karmic value for us. Because if that stuff is not cleared out, it's going to affect what? Our choices, which are going to affect our thoughts and our conduct. And it's going to affect our intention, too. So all this stuff that you know, we don't want to deal with, when you understand the import of tonight's discussion, really become important. You know, and at some point, part of this is saying, okay, I even if I don't want to, I need to take this stuff on. I have to do it in a smart way, you know. But at some point, I got to take this on if I actually have an aspiration and intention to get free from my suffering. I got to take it on. Boy, that's at least in my life. That's a tough reality, you know. But you know, the Buddha said that this is a practice. You're swimming upstream. You know that. That most people aren't going to want to do some of this stuff, and this is one of them. Yeah, right. So, okay. Well, listen, I just have to tell you, I am so happy to be in this building tonight with these tankas and the Buddha. I mean, you can really see it starting to come together, right? It's starting to happen. This is really exciting. And I'm really happy to be here with you. It's really great to see this size of a group, and you know, to be with a group of people who actually want to explore these things. So I'd like to thank you.
Big gratitude.
Yeah, very, very, very much. And may our intention to explore this and to work on ourselves in some true and genuine way, reduce the suffering in our life and for the people around us and for all beings everywhere. So thank you.